The night may be long and the dark may be deep, but the answers are there to be found. Whether it's the normal, the abnormal, or the paranormal, you're in the right place. Let's go beyond reality.
Good evening, good morning, and welcome. It's Beyond Reality Radio. I'm your host, JV Johnson. Jason has the night off tonight. Thanks for joining us. Another great program on tap for you tonight. We're going to be talking with Ray Shemansky. Ray is interested in the quest for truth about extraterrestrial visitation from the perspective of a former senior scientist for the government. Ray spent many years working at the Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, a place that is reported to have a direct and frequent UFO and alien connection. In fact, the debris from the Roswell crash is said to have ended up at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Our guest, Ray Shemansky, knows the details of this. We're going to talk to him about that tonight. We will, of course, take your phone calls in the second part of the program at 844-687-7669 is our listener line. And we'd love to have your comments and questions as we continue the night. And again, that'll be in the second part of the show. We also have a bunch of great stuff coming up later in the week here. Tomorrow night, Dylan Avery, who is the director of a film called Loose Change. You've probably heard of that, related to the 9/11 attacks. And he's also got a film out called Black and Blue. And we're going to be discussing those films, plus CBD and his new documentary about that called Magic Molecule. That'll be a great discussion in the first hour of our program tomorrow night. And then in the second hour, Lee Austin will be with us to talk about Flat Earth Theory. Now, I know we've spoken about that recently, and we don't like to, you know, revisit too many topics too quickly here on the program. But Lee has been on the program a number of times, and he has a new concept, a new idea, and a new approach to this. So we'll have him on in the second part of the program to talk about that. And that is tomorrow night. Then Thursday, Lee Harris will be with us. Lee Harris is an energy healer, and he'll give practical guidance, inspiration, and a clear blueprint for growth and change, including how to invoke the help of our spirit guides and angels. That's something that we could all use now and then, right? I know I could. Looking ahead to next week, of course, Friday will be a best of program. Next week, one thing I did want to mention about next week's schedule, because if you remember a couple of weeks ago when the Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris burned tragically, there was a connection between Nostradamus and predicting that fire, according to some people who study Nostradamus. And we quickly had a guest on. We got him last minute. He's a Nostradamus scholar and expert to talk about that connection. He said that he doesn't read it the same way, and that was John Hoag. Now, John was only with us for a few minutes that night, but we made him promise that he would come back and spend an entire program talking about Nostradamus. And we're going to do that next Tuesday night. John Hoag will be with us. The whole show will be talking about Nostradamus and his predictions. Many people believe he was a prophet. Some people say he was just a guy that wrote some things down, and if you interpret them the right way, you can say they came true. Either way, John Hoag will talk about his work, and I know John believes he had some prophetic skills or abilities, and we'll talk about those with John Hoag Tuesday night next week. That should be a great one as well. Stop by our Facebook page, Beyond Reality Radio. Also, please subscribe to mine or like mine, JV Johnson, on Facebook. The easiest way to find it is just look for JVJ Paranormal, and you can find my Facebook page. Give it a like. We're going to get those numbers up there. And then I'm going to send you over to YouTube. If you haven't seen the YouTube channel, it's a great place to find back shows. There is a video stream involved. We do some live streaming there. And if you don't have a radio station option in your area and you're looking for another way to participate in the show, that YouTube stream is live each night. And we have a great chat room around it, too. The YouTube channel is JV Johnson on YouTube. So find that, subscribe to it, click the little bell icon so that you get notifications when we upload videos and when we do our live streaming. That's going to do it for our housekeeping stuff. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll bring our guest in. Again, tonight, we're going to be talking with Ray Shemansky about Wright-Patterson Air Force Base and its connection to alien and UFO phenomena. It's Beyond Reality Radio.
Hey, it's JV here. You know I've asked for your support in the past, and I'm going to do it again because it's really, really important. And there are a couple of ways you can support the show, and it's so inexpensive. Now, you can go to Patreon, and you can become a Patreon supporter, and we really, really encourage that. But there's also another way. If you look at the description of the podcast, if you're a podcast listener, and you scroll down to the bottom, there's a way to support the show directly through the podcast app. And it's only 99 cents a month. It's less than a buck. You probably have that change in your couch right now. That dollar a month, less than a dollar, goes a long way in helping us produce this program, provide great interviews for you during the course of the week. I thank you in advance because the support is so important to the program.
Phone lines will be open in the second hour of the program. It's at 844-687-7669. Tonight, our guest is Ray Shemansky. Ray is an author, a paranormal researcher, also a longtime worker at the Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, where anyone who has followed the story of alien appearances, abductions, Roswell crash, and U.S. and government involvement of any of that knows that the Wright-Patterson Air Force Base has long been a source of controversy and rumored to be a site where much of this information and activity has taken place. And our guest will talk more about that as we have our conversation tonight. Rafe, welcome to Beyond Reality Radio. Thanks for being here tonight.
Thanks for inviting me. Appreciate it.
So I want to get to know you a little bit first here before we get into the meat of this discussion. Tell us a little bit about when this type of thing, paranormal, anything, whether it's UFOs, aliens, ghosts, anything paranormal, first attracted your attention.
I was 1973 in January. It was my first week on the base. I was a cooperative education student from the University of Detroit, electrical engineering major. And about the first week, I was assigned to a mentor. His name was Al. And we were in a two-story office building, which was connected to a 250-foot-long hangar. And on the other side of the hangar was an identical two-story office building. So he said, hey, let's go. I'll show you where the Greasy Spoon is at, you know, the local coffee shop. So we step out of our building and go into the connected hangar, and it's dark and it's dusty. And he turns to me and says, have you heard about our aliens?
Wow.
So I'm this co-op student. I don't know anything from aliens, from you know, the man on the moon. And so we have a little conversation. He explains to me that there was a crash wreckage out west. It was brought to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base for evaluation and possible exploitation. And, you know, I eventually learned that there was a widespread knowledge of Wright-Patterson's connection to UFOs because Project Blue Book had been there for nearly 22 years and it had only ended just in 1969. So that was less than 4 years until I showed up. So the base was fairly well. They knew that Wright-Pat was connected. So at that point, it kind of lit a little spark in me. And, you know, as my career went on, I always kind of peeked around corners and talked to people about it and got a lot of reassurances that Wright-Pat had a lot to do with that.
So you didn't have an interest in any of this before you started working at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. This all happened once you got the job there.
Pretty much didn't have a clue. I mean, I can remember growing up in Detroit and stargazing, that kind of thing, and being interested in the early space race. But it really wasn't until I got on base and my mentor for that work study term brought it up. And you know, I started reading everything I could when I could, and that was really the beginning.
When he brought it up, you hadn't been there very long. You were, I guess, by all measures, a rookie. What do you think his motivation was for talking to you about it so blatantly, if in fact it is such a well-guarded secret in so many circles?
Well, I think he wasn't really giving me any kind of secret. I think it was, you know, it was almost fraternity-like, perhaps. Mm-hmm. But I think the real meaning of it all was that there was a connection between Wright-Patterson and the UFOs and extraterrestrials. And people were best able to talk about it in terms of us having the aliens and the crash wreckage, and they were in the tunnels. And so it kind of is this sometimes often factology, sometimes mythology that grows within the community. And then you tell the next person because it's really something special. And, you know, it's something that you can, you know, like storytelling, like tribes, sure. You know, ancient tribes. You're passing on the story to the next generation saying, hey, this is a special place to work. We do special things here. And one of them just happens to be this UFO connection that Wright-Patterson has.
When you got the job there, had you been aware of that connection prior? I know you didn't really have an interest in it, but did you have any awareness of it?
Nothing. Absolutely nothing. I was like, hey, a job, I'm going to get to pay for the rest of my education. I'm going to get some experience here. I had zero clue. Absolutely not. Now, you got to imagine, no, this is like, you know, pre-internet days. We're talking ancient history here. So it would have required yet another trip to a library somewhere or, you know, another source to try to find out information about Wright-Patt. And I just didn't do it. I was just busy getting my exams done and getting, you know, ready to go off on this adventure. I'd really never been away from home, and I was going to be there with three other young engineering students. We're all going to share an apartment. So there was just so much administrivia to do. I didn't really bother to look up what Wright-Patterson was really all about. I just said, hey, a job for an electronics engineer? Sure, you're paying good money. I'm your guy.
Well, you make a good point because we're so used to information just being thrown at us in so many directions through the digital age, whether it's social media or other digital information sources, that we're almost all aware of virtually, not necessarily everything, but certainly pieces of almost everything. Back prior to the internet and the digital age, unless you were specifically hunting for this kind of information, it probably wouldn't have made it in front of your face. It didn't show up necessarily in any mainstream media. So if you weren't looking for it, you didn't see it.
Yeah, and by 1973, you know, Project Blue Book had ended in 69. So if there was any kind of sensationalist coverage about Wright-Patterson, it had ended at least a couple of years before that. So, you know, the fact that it was revealed to me, I think just kind of shows how widespread it was. And in fact, you know, there was a thing called the U.S. Air Force UFO Identification Chart, and it's basically you know, us laughing at the Air Force's explanation that it's a weather balloon. And this chart has all these different airborne objects. It's got, you know, the Starship Enterprise and a Klingon battleship and a classic saucer-shaped UFO and a weather balloon. And each of these objects on the Air Force identification chart, underneath it says weather balloon. and so that was very widespread back then. And today, they've actually upped the ante because they now print T-shirts with that same Air Force UFO identification chart on it.
That's
so
hilarious.
The connection between Wright-Patt and UFOs didn't die in 1969 when Project Blue Book ended. It still continues to this day.
Yeah, it absolutely does. When your mentor was first telling you this, saying, hey, did you hear about our aliens? Did you think he was joking?
Well, Al didn't strike me as a jokester kind of guy. He struck me as an intellectual kind of guy. And in fact, he proved that out because he actually spent a good portion of his career as a member of the senior executive service. So for the listeners, if you look at the general service scale that they had for engineers and executives, you could go up to a GS-15. But if you were approved by Congress, you could go up one more level, and that would make you the equivalent of a flag officer, like a U.S. Army or Air Force general or a Navy admiral. So that is, you know, your general officer level. He actually went on to earn an SCS ranking. So he wound up being at the general officer level. So this just was not some, you know, kind of, you know, fly-by-night mid-level engineer. He was quite accomplished in his career.
For those who might not be familiar with Wright-Patterson, tell us where it's actually located geographically.
Okay. Geographically, if you go about 60 miles west of Columbus and you go about 60 miles north of Cincinnati, you'll come to an intersection of Interstate 70 and Interstate 75. And Wright-Patterson Air Force Base is located on a 45-degree angle to the southeast, about 15 miles from there. So it basically borders places like Huber Heights, Fairborn, Ohio.
Well, see, we talk about this stuff, and we mysteriously lose our guest. This is not the first time this has happened to us, right? Anybody who listens to this program is aware that whenever we start talking about something that there is a bit of a government cover-up involved, at least one that we suspect or maybe are curious about, we end up losing our guests. Are you with us, Ray? All right, we're going to need to have Slick get Ray back on the phone. So we're talking with Ray Shemansky. Ray is a long-timer, was a long-time employee at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, a U.S. government facility, an Air Force facility that has a long-standing, at least rumored, connection with alien activity and alien evidence. And in fact, some people suggest they're reverse engineering alien technology at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, among many, many other things. The original Roswell crash debris was reported to have gone to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and it's reported to still be there. So when we get our guest back on the line, Ray Shemansky, we're going to talk a little bit more about that. Ray has a couple books out. One is called 50 Shades of Greys. You know, the aliens, Greys. Nice play on words. The second one is 50 Shades of Greys, Victoria's Secret Truths. And both of those books are available at Amazon, and you should check out Ray's website as well. Google Ray Shemansky. It's S-Z-Y-M-A-N-S-K-I. What we're going to do here is, I think we've got Ray back, but we need to go to break, so we're going to take the break. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit about the history of Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. How long has it been in existence? What's its military mission supposed to be? All those kind of things, you know, the questions that anybody might have if they didn't realize there's an alien connection. And again, we will be taking your phone calls at 844-687-7669 in the second hour of the program. It's Beyond Reality Radio. Please support the program. Go to patreon.com/Johaw. That's J-O-H-A-W. Let's, first of all, we lost you there, and it's very, very curious to me, and I know that you're on a cell phone, so, you know, the connection can get a little bit unreliable at times, but it seems like anytime we talk about this particular topic, and we talk about government involvement and cover-up, we always have some kind of problem, whether it's internet going out or phones being disconnected. You've been at this a long time. Have you seen or experienced any of that phenomena that you might be a little suspicious of?
Oh, definitely. I had a internet problem when I was going to upload my first book because it's self-published, and I had to upload it so that they could process it on their end up at CreateSpace. And the internet connection kept failing. It wasn't that large of a book, 250 pages, about 100 photos, and it just kept failing. And so I had the AT&T guy come out, through which I had the service, and he said, "You're only 10 feet from your router." And he's saying, "The signal's strong. There's 5 bars on your computer showing that you're connected." He goes, "I cannot figure out why you keep getting the disconnect." And I said, "Well, you're the expert, you know." Yeah. So now I'm really worried. I had him out 3 different times, and it was so frustrating because I'm trying to upload this book, and I'm going to just use the word coincidentally to be kind. Coincidentally, it took me a couple of days to finally get it accomplished because it just kept cutting out. And I've experienced some suspicious other kind of communications. I would call it denial of service attacks. So I have some evidence, but I'm not sure I really have the proof.
Well, these coincidences seem to be awfully common whenever you circle around these topics. Let's talk a little bit more about the Air Force Base itself. What's the history of the base? How long has it been there? And what is the official mission of that particular Air Force Base?
Well, there are probably at any one time 20 to 30,000 people assigned to the base.
Wow.
So it's massive. It has over 600 buildings. It has 8,000 acres. There's actually two areas. There's an active landing strip operational area called Area A, and then there's Area B, which is the more businessy end of it. Air Force Research Lab headquarters is stationed there, and it has several, I think about maybe 2,000 employees, so it forms a big part. So you have the Air Force Research Labs is in Area B, and so most of the major research and development that occurs for the U.S. Air Force is centered there. And then you have other tenants. You have the Air Force Institute of Technology, and that's where people go to get graduate degrees, master's degrees, and things that are related to aeronautical engineering. You can get PhDs there. There's the Air Force Lifecycle Management Center. There's Air Force Materiel Command. And so you have the people that basically look at the requirements that the Air Force has for a new weapon system, a platform, say, the next F-15 or the next F-22 or the next, Joint Strike Fighter. And they put all of those requirements together. And they basically raise an airplane and, get it put on the runway and actively defending this country, from A to Z at Wright-Patterson. So it's a huge mission. And the split is generally about 15,000 civilians and anywhere between 10 and 15,000 military basically assigned to the base.
And I assume it's been there a while.
I believe that, there was originally a place called McCook Field, which was downtown, and then there was Wright Field, and then there was Patterson Field. McCook eventually closed, and then about 1917, I believe, is when I believe Wright Field was actually founded. And I know for a fact that the Materials Directorate, which is now part of Air Force Research Labs, was founded there in 1917, and that's a good backstory for something we can talk about later when we talk about recovered metals and stuff. And I believe the two bases, the Wright Field and Patterson Field, were actually joined under the Wright-Patterson name in about 1948. So roughly about 1917 for the first part of the actual Wright-Patterson was put into operation.
Do you have any suspicion that the base itself was constructed specifically with the idea in mind that extraterrestrial UFO activity was going to be studied there?
Well, it was constructed 30 years before anyone really heard about it. 1947 is when,
before we heard
about Roswell crash material was brought there. And there's no doubt that the material was brought there because two of the key witnesses who handled the material went on legal record and said that whatever was recovered there went to Wright-Patterson.
And that's, of course, before we heard of any of this UFO activity. I would suspect that if the federal government or the military knew of it before we did, they certainly weren't going to tell us.
Yeah, but I think 1947, if you look at the historical records, you go back, that's pretty much when the thing reared its ugly head. But if you think about it, the Materials Directorate was founded in 1917. So by 1947, they had been working with materials that fly in the air for 30 years. So Wright-Patterson would have been the natural place to bring this material that we really didn't understand at the time, because you would have the materials experts on the base. They would have the expertise. They would have the equipment. They would have security and vaults and guards and fences. They would have secrecy oaths. They had funding. So it was really the perfect storm, the perfect place to bring something that you gathered in the desert and that displayed these unusual properties of, I can't burn it, I can't dent it, I can't cut it. So that's why Wright-Patterson would have been chosen.
Okay, so 1947, we have the Roswell incident, we've got a crash, we've got various and conflicting reports of what happened there. From what you know, based on your time at Wright-Patterson, what happened?
Well, Jesse Marcel and Sheridan Cavett were sent with the rancher, Mac Brazel, to go back up near Corona, about 70 miles northwest of Roswell, and pick the stuff up. And in their testimony, especially Jesse Marcel, he said, we picked up thousands of little pieces, thousands. And the largest piece he ever mentions is about a 2 foot by a 3 foot piece. But Jesse also said in an interview with Stanton Friedman, that material was not of this planet, and he went on to say why. And he also said, I do know it went to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Well, then you have another person, Thomas DuBose, a general who worked as the chief of staff in the 8th Army Air Force headquarters in Fort Worth, and that is the location through which the material passed from Roswell on its way to Wright-Patterson. And late in his life, General DuBose signed an affidavit that said that material went to Wright-Patterson.
So
you have two immutable sources.
Yeah, so it arrives at Wright-Patterson. What do they do with it?
Well, most likely what would have happened is they would have brought a small portion of it. You know, Jesse said, I picked up thousands of pieces that were like 1 inch by 1 inch. So they probably would have brought a briefcase full, made arrangements to meet with the head of the materials director and said, look, guys, some guy picked this up. It has some unusual properties with our cursory testing, and we would like you to tell us everything you can about this material. And we'll give you, you know, X amount of dollars, X amount of weeks or months to look at it, but just write us a report. Tell us what you can. And I'm sure that there were some conversations going back and forth. Eventually, the materials directorate and maybe some other labs at the time that were in existence would have looked at it and said, here's what we know, here's a report. All the people who handled it, and there would have been just a few, maybe a few top scientists, maybe a dozen. They would have been sworn to secrecy. There would have been one or maybe two copies of the report, and off it went into history.
The rumors that surround this have been circulating for a very, very long time, and there are a lot of people that are emphatic that the story you just told is the actual truth. Were you ever given any access to seeing any of that that material, or were you ever given any access to files that would support what we're being told?
Absolutely not. No.
Yeah.
No, I worked in a different area. Most of my work was involved in software. So, no, I would imagine that secret got buried back in 1947 on the base. And that's not to say that scenario didn't replay itself, you know, throughout the decades. If they recovered other things, then it probably would have gone right back to Wright-Patterson for the same reason. In 2017, the materials lab celebrated 100 years on the base. I mean, that's a lot of expertise. That's a lot of experience. And if, you know, other agencies were to bring them things that were picked up, I'm sure they would take it to Wright-Patterson for the exact reasons that the Roswell stuff was brought there in 1947.
Ray, I want to take you back to the story that you told, how this whole concept and this idea was introduced to you by your mentor. There was some, I guess, misinterpretation of that. What was misinterpreted about that story?
Well, most of the people who have interviewed me or talked to me about this, they tried to get me to say that was the proof, that was the evidence that indeed all those events happened. And I think the clarification is that what it really represents is the fact that almost the entire community at Wright-Patterson was aware of the connection between Wright-Patterson and UFOs because of the Project Blue Book and other things that were written locally about the Air Force UFO investigation. So it really, I never viewed it so much, and even in the long term, never viewed it so much as, well, this is evidence because this guy, you know, went on to become a member of the SES, and he must have known because he was a high-level, a very high-ranking civilian. Well, he really wasn't at the time he made the revelation. And I could ask, you know, Doug in accounting, hey, Doug, what do you know about the connection? And he'd say, oh, yeah, we're well aware that, you know, the Wright-Patt guys in the Foreign Technology Division on the other side of the base in Area A, you know, they had worked the UFO investigation for over 20 years. So it was, I guess, a widely kept secret that Wright-Patt and UFOs were connected.
So
and that's what it's about.
Yeah, you said there was about 15,000, I think that was the number you used, civilian employees at Wright-Patterson. How many of those, or whatever the number is, were professionals such as yourself, people that may have actually been involved in whether it was reverse engineering or studying or explaining or hiding this connection with the UFOs and extraterrestrials?
Well, Air Force Research Lab headquarters is there, and you had the sensors directorate. Well, they're now called directorates instead of labs, but they're essentially a lab. You know, you have their specialties. You have, you know, sensors lab, you have materials lab, you have propulsion lab, a human performance lab. And so there's a lot of those disciplines that could be applied to anything that wasn't ours that we either recovered or were given. So, you know, the hardcore people, you know, who actually looked at that initially, you know, could have numbered in the dozens. But as years go by, as other things are brought in, now think about it, the Foreign Technology Division is there, and their job is to get things like MiG fighters. And they have a MiG fighter sitting out in front of their building that they bought from some country. Well, you bet that thing was taken apart and examined and evaluated for its capabilities. You know, that job alone might have required hundreds or thousands of people to look at it. So I think it's indeterminate how many people would look at, let's say, recovered metals or some recovered object, like maybe an integrated circuit or something. Tens, maybe hundreds, you know, through the years. I'm not really sure I can put a finger on it. But the fact is that you have everything you need to do that kind of a job at Wright-Patt.
Yeah. And what about, and we only have a couple minutes here before our top of the hour break, but what about actual storage facilities and space? How much space is available to, say, hide alien spacecraft or debris from a crash?
Well, you think about it, it was described as being thousands of one-inch square parts, so you don't need much, you know, a couple of boxes. Right. The Wright-Patt has, I'm going to just throw out a number, I'm probably wrong, but they have three dozen hangars, each with, you know, maybe a minimum width of 200 feet across and 100 feet deep. So, you know, you could store 1,000 30-foot crafts on the base and, you know, and close the doors on them. So there's plenty of space there. They have over 600 buildings. And again, you know, we're not talking, you know, a 90-foot spacecraft, even though we could fit maybe a dozen of those in a single hangar.
Right.
And the Air Force owns millions of square feet where they store all the relics that eventually make it to the Air Force Museum. So they've got more space than they ever need.
Now, you're not the only person to come forward with much of this information. However, even given the numbers that you're talking about, the number of people that, whether they were military or civilian, that have been on the base, how is it such a well-kept secret?
Well, I think it's neat to know, and that's always the way it's been. Now, look at the presidents. Carter, Reagan, Clinton, you know, all those guys wanted to be briefed on the UFO thing, and they weren't, simply because they didn't have need to know. So it's the same thing, you know, and compartmentalization. Now, you think about it. They bring in the debris in a briefcase. They take it to the director of the materials directorate. He handpicks a couple of scientists and engineers. Now you only got five or six people knowing about it.
Yeah.
It doesn't take, and in many cases, they might give a scientist a piece of metal and say, just tell us what you know about this and don't ask any questions. And there's nothing he can say because he just simply had a piece of metal.
So it's similar to what we've learned about maybe the JFK conspiracy or other conspiracies where the information is so compartmentalized, you don't put it all together. Therefore, you don't really have a story to tell.
Yes, and then, you know, you swear the one or two guys that ran the machine, you know, like maybe an EDX machine or, you know, they're looking at the elemental composition of the metal, or they're looking at the isotopic ratios of the metal. And they just run in the machine, and 5 minutes later, well, today, I'm not sure in 1947, but today, in a couple of minutes, they've got that information, and, you know, they sign off on it, and away it goes, and they're sworn to secrecy. So it's really pretty easy to do.
Yeah. All right. Well, we've got a lot more to talk about with our guest tonight, Ray Shemanski. Check out his website. Check out his books, 50 Shades of Greys. That's G-R-E-Y-S, Greys as in the alien race. And we're going to take your calls and questions at 844-687-7669. It's Beyond Reality Radio. Don't go away. We have a lot more to come.
Hey, it's JV here. You know I've asked for your support in the past, and I'm going to do it again because it's really, really important. And there are a couple of ways you can support the show, and it's so inexpensive. Now, you can go to Patreon, and you can become a Patreon supporter, and we really, really encourage that. But there's also another way. If you look at the description of the podcast, if you're a podcast listener, and you scroll down to the bottom, there's a way to support the show directly through the podcast app. And it's only 99 cents a month. It's less than a buck. You probably have that change in your couch right now. That dollar a month, less than a dollar, goes a long way in helping us produce this program, provide great interviews for you during the course of the week. I thank you in advance because the support is so important to the program.
Thanks for joining us. If you're listening on one of the radio stations carrying the program, I think you should thank them as well for carrying it. We appreciate their participation and their membership in the affiliate family for Beyond Reality Radio. If you're listening online or you're listening as a download later, we welcome you as well. Tonight, we're talking with Ray Shemansky. Ray is a paranormal researcher and an author, a longtime employee at the Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. We all know the connection, at least rumored connection, which Ray is clearing up for us, the rumored connections of the Wright-Patterson Air Force Base and UFO and alien activity. We're going to bring him back in just a moment. I'll remind you, tomorrow night, Dylan Avery will be with us for the first part of the program tomorrow. He's the director of a film called Loose Change, which looked at the controversy over the 9/11 conspiracy. And also Black and Blue is another film that looks at police brutality. And then we'll be talking about his new documentary. It's called Magic Molecule, and it's about CBD. In the second hour of the program, Lee Austin will return. He has been on the show a few times. He's got a new idea surrounding flat earth theory that he wanted to present to us. So he'll be with us for a little while tomorrow night in the second half of the show. Thursday, Lee Harris will be with us to talk about his work as an energy healer. He'll also give practical guidance, inspiration, and a clear blueprint for growth and change, including how to invoke the help of our spirit guides and angels. So you can see we've got a lot of great shows coming up. I want to bring our guest, Ray Shemansky, back into the show now. Ray, I mentioned, and you have mentioned, the words reverse engineering several times. Were you personally ever involved in doing any of this reverse engineering work, whether it was with alien technology or human technology?
Yeah, it was clearly human technology. Looked like perhaps a projectile of some sort with a control system, and my job was to look at some of the circuit boards and create a schematic diagram so that the more senior engineers at that point could look at it and try to figure out what the function of the board was. And then, you know, when all of the boards were completed and we showed the connections on a giant schematic, then they could get an idea of the capabilities of the object from which those printed circuit cards that were loaded with components, what it actually did.
We know that, you know, the Soviets during the Cold War had a lot of unusual technology and craft. We also know that our own military was doing many of the same things, testing things, experimental aircraft. And often I think there's a good reason to believe that some things that are called UFO or alien craft might be misidentified human technology. How common do you think that is or was?
To misidentify our technology,
yeah,
whether, or alien technology?
Yeah, well,
I guess, you know, you hear about the F-117s and, you know, that was, they were flying that stuff, things that might have gone off range. You know, they did a lot of experimental things out at Edwards Air Force Base. And, you know, there was some population around there, not much, but there's some. So I think some of the reports are certainly attributable to that. It makes sense. But I think, for the most part, there are enough substantial cases out there to prove the existence of the phenomena.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, too. What about the famous Hangar 18, where that Roswell material was supposedly taken? Does that really exist?
You know, my theory is that there was probably some writer who had to put an article on Wright-Patterson together, and he wanted to create something that the reading public could hang on to, a point of reference. So I think that somebody invented the title Hangar 18, and then they said, yeah, that's where they store all the stuff at Wright-Patterson, because we have 600 buildings there and 8,000 acres. You know, they're going to go, oh, it's all scattered on the base. No, so let me give you a solid object. Now, that being said, I actually went on a hunt for, you know, if there was a Hangar 18, what building would it be? And I've narrowed it down to, you know, a handful, a good half a dozen buildings that I think we're in the right place at the right time, have the right people working in there. We're close enough to the active flight line into which, you know, they used to fly the B-29 bomber that was loaded with the material in. So, you know, if there is a Hangar 18, you know, I think it's probably an Area B. But that said, we don't really need a Hangar 18 to make the phenomena true because, again, Jesse Marcel said, I picked up thousands of one-inch square pieces in the desert. You don't need a hangar, okay? And hangars don't generally house labs. Now, they do in some occasions, but most likely, if it's a piece of material, it'd go to the materials directorate. It'd be just a standard building, you know, filled with electronics and that sort of thing. So not really a hangar. You don't really need a hangar to examine the metals picked out of the desert.
Well, a lot of what we keep going back to is the Roswell crash. But I know as well that others have contended that Wright-Patterson has actually living alien creatures in it, in addition to full-size alien craft. Do you know anything about any of that, and do you suspect that might be true?
Well, I've heard the rumors of that, but I've also heard many other rumors that weren't Wright-Pat, but were UFO stuff. But again, if we go back to the basics and you say, why Wright-Patterson? Why would they do that? Well, you have the expertise. You have Air Force Research Lab headquarters, meaning you've got tons of technical expertise. If you don't own that, you can always rent time by a professor who's got a certain level of expertise in some subject. You have the security. You have secrecy oaths. You have funding. You have contracting. So you have everything you could possibly want. Bring it in the middle of the night. There's not many people out there except for security police, and they're probably tipped off. Bring it in a dark truck, bring it into a building, and nobody's the wiser except the person who's working on it. So, again, it's just one of many perfect places to do that kind of research.
One of the things I noticed about your website and information about you and about your book, you mentioned Men in Black. You say, are the Men in Black real? What do you know about Men in Black?
Well, I actually had an encounter with a gentleman who was standing outside a building, and we already mentioned that before, the Foreign Technology Building, which is now the National Air and Space Intelligence Center, I think, NASIC. And he was standing out there, and he was dressed in a dark suit. You know, this is like late May, so it's super hot, super humid in Dayton that time of year. And he's sitting in the shadow of a tree, you know, looking at a smartphone, and he's got the black hat on and the dark suit. And it, you know, I was playing a golf course at the time, and it just struck me, bam, you know, hit me like a ton of bricks. So I went over and actually talked to the guy. Actually, I talked to him twice. Point blank, asked him if he was, you know, I knew which building he worked in, and asked him if he was, you know, a man in black, and kind of in a casual, humorous sort of way. But I was kind of in a semi panic at that point. And he, of course, he denied it. And then I checked with somebody who had actually worked in that building and said that they knew the individual and claimed that they were just a, you know, normal analyst. But then again, when I quizzed my friend and said, well, do you know everything that guy does? And he said, well, frankly, I don't. And I said, so there is a possibility that he could indeed be a man in black. And he looked at me. He goes, yeah, quite possibly. You know, because, again, you've got this compartmentalization, and many times you don't know what the guy next door is doing. So who knows if the guy isn't employed in that capacity at some time during the day, week, or month.
And that brings me to black helicopters. If they're going to be anywhere, they're going to be a Wright-Pat, right? Have you seen anything like that, that, you know, these mysterious or mythical black helicopters that show up?
I've seen them, but not at Wright-Pat.
Oh, really?
Yes. Really?
Have you seen?
And I cannot tell you where, but
oh, okay.
I have seen unmarked helicopters. In fact, I probably saw a cluster of five or six.
Can you
and
tell?
They were clearly unmarked.
Can you tell us if they were they coming looking for you, or did you just happen to observe it?
No, I think they were just returning to home base.
I see. your book talks about all of this, of course. When you say that you're out to look for the truth, you're on a quest for the truth about UFOs and ETs. I mean, you've got access to information that many, many don't, or you've been able to observe things that many, many people haven't. Do you think we're going to get to a point where there's going to be some kind of reveal on all this?
One, I'm not sure we're ready for it. Two, there's been some interesting things. I think just today or yesterday, there was some revelation that the I-team has now got a paper trail showing that the government actually released the Tic Tac and the gimbal and some other video, you know, that's really been splashed across the front pages, you know, and all the TV shows. So it appears as if somebody is letting that go. The reason why they're doing it, I'm not sure, is a full disclosure. It could just be that, you know, they're saying, forget everything we told you before, but we're just talking present day. We're recognizing now that there's some anomalous things in our airspace, and we want to make sure that, you know, our military pilots and our commercial pilots are reporting this, because we're now concerned that it's happening more often. So is this really a disclosure? No, because it really doesn't discuss all the things in the past, like crash recoveries. It's just saying, you know, we're noticing some objects in the sky, and I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, the other shoe's going to fall, and it's going to be another one of those planet Venus, you know, dancing stars, ice crystals in the sky kind of explanations.
Yeah.
So I'm not holding my breath.
Yeah, those explanations are very, very common and very frequent and almost laughable at times. What's the website for people to go to find out more information about your work, and where can they find the books?
The books are available on Amazon. The best thing to do is type in three keywords, 50, shades, and UFO. And they'll find my books on Amazon. They'll find recordings of other interviews and some other things like that. And they can look up Ray Shemansky on a Wix site. I have a pretty humble footprint out there on the web. I'm happily retired after 40 years, and never thought this would be a second career, although it's turning into that. So
sure.
They can find me on Wix site, WIXSITE, and type in my name.
Right, they can probably
should come up.
Yeah, they can probably Google you and get there too. Now, we're going to have a whole other segment on the other side of this break, but we've got about 4 minutes here. I want to ask you, because we mentioned things like phones being disconnected. You said you had a problem with the internet when you were trying to upload the book the first time. Any other misadventures or anything that is a little suspicious while you were researching this book?
Well, one of the interesting things that happened to me in Exeter when I went out to the site of the Muscarello, the 1965 sighting, and I was sitting in my car, and a disembodied voice appeared outside the driver's window and asked me what I was doing there. And I explained I was a researcher, and they said, well, they're not coming back. There's nothing here for you to see. You need to leave. And I didn't see a car approach my car or anything. So somebody had either come out of the woods or dropped out of the sky or who knows what. And they said that to me on three different occasions as I was trying to explain my presence there. And I was stunned. I was pretty shocked. And I just finally said, I caved. I said, well, okay, fine, I'm going to leave. And I did, because I had no idea who they were, what they were, and you know, whether they had an army of people in the adjoining woods. So I basically left. It was a pretty scary situation.
Wow. That is scary. You know, we've had other folks talk about similar incidents. I mean, you just don't know, and you don't know the lengths they'll go to prevent information from getting out. I mean, we've seen some things that are pretty extreme.
I also had an incident in Rendlesham when I went there, and I noticed that there was a car parked all day at the entry point where most researchers would enter to kind of retrace the steps of Peniston and Burroughs and the boys. And it turns out that the car was registered in a town 2 hours away, and that town is host to a intelligence center. And I thought, that's strange. Maybe they were observing the people coming in and out of Rendlesham Forest that day, you know, trying to get a bead on who's doing research, which I thought was unusual, a little paranoid on my part. But nonetheless, you know, somebody wasn't just there, you know, on a, I'm in a neighborhood. It actually came from a place that, that hosts an intelligence center 2 hours distant from Rendlesham Forest.
Ray, the first book is subtitled Evidence of Extraterrestrial Visitation to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base and Beyond. What's the difference between the first and the second book?
Well, the first book, I went to famous sites and I tried to find new witnesses. I tried to interview old witnesses. In the second book, I did a 2-year case study of a family that has had multi-generational contact with entities that they're not quite sure what they are. Under regression, the principal character in the book, Victoria, after whom the book was named, she mentions things like iridescent insectoids in robes, mantises, grays. So she mentions many different species of entities, aliens, if you will, that she's come in contact with since she was a young girl. And the regressions that were performed, she's had 4 regressions performed. Those regressions were performed by 3 of the top hypnotherapists or, you know, medical therapists, whatever their official titles are, in the world. And they include Dr. Leo Sprinkle, Yvonne Smith, and Barbara Lamb. So through those regressions, we learned that a lot of these very fuzzy memories that she had from childhood as a girl, she had these memories of ant people crawling around her ceiling and that type of thing. Those were actually screen memories, and she was actually being abducted and has been unwillingly participating in an alien breeding program. So I collected all the photographic, clinical, medical, narrative evidence, put it to the stress test, and that which didn't pass, didn't get published, those things that I think make a strong case for that reality are contained in the book.
So did you say that they were screen memories? Is that what you said?
Yeah, a screen memory is either induced by the person who abducted you or there's something that they're self-induced. So a lot of people who are contactees, they'll see an alien gray that have an oversized eye, and there will be sometimes a self-induced screen memory. Well, they'll remember seeing owls in a dream or deer or any large-eyed animal where, in fact, they're trying to put a memory there that is allows them to cope with the trauma, having been taken from their room and perhaps subjected to some kind of medical testing. In other cases, the abductors themselves are known to impart a screen memory so that the person who has been abducted will not remember exactly what happened to them.
And you say she, and I think you said her name was Victoria, which is in the title of the book there, has been in an alien breeding program?
Yeah, she has had, under regression, she explains that she believes that they're removing eggs from her to perhaps be fertilized. And in other cases, she talks about something being placed inside of her. And if you read about, if you do abduction research, you know, you read the classic books like Dr. Jacobs, Yvonne Smith, Barbara Lamb, Dr. Sprinkle, you'll discover that the theory is that when the women believe something's put inside of them, it's a developing fetus, and they'll gestate it for 30 to 60 days, and then it is a very critical stage in the fetus development, and then it'll be removed. And this will account for a lot of what people think were false pregnancies, when really they weren't pregnant, but they had actually hosted a fetus for some time, and it caused a hormonal change in the body, and it gets detected, and then suddenly they're, quote, no longer pregnant. So this type of thing is a result of females being involved in an alien breeding program.
Now, you chronicle this in your second book, and you chronicle this particular case. How common do you think this is?
I don't know. The people who really know the answer to that are some of the names I mentioned before, Dr. David Jacobs, Yvonne Smith, Barbara Lamb, Dr. Sprinkle, because they have regressed thousands of contactees. I think probably the best book on the entire phenomena was a book put out, you know, years ago by Dr. Jacobs. It's called The Threat. And therein, he uses the testimony of hundreds of his patients to describe what's going on. And he took all the familiarities between their cases and was able to make some pretty interesting points about what the agenda is and how it happens and that type of thing. It's a fantastic, insightful book. But I use that as a reference to bounce what Victoria was telling me about her own situation, and I could see that a lot of what she was telling me was included in the book and other books. But when I quizzed her, she said, "No, I really never read any of those books, so I would like be a copycat." And clearly, she didn't fake three world class therapists into believing her story. So I think it's got a very good foundation.
Do you have a sense, and maybe you don't know the answer to this, or maybe she didn't even know the answer to this, but are those fetuses human fetuses or are they alien fetuses?
Well, according to the research, you know, they're fertilized with a human sperm, and then they're injected or spliced in with some alien DNA, and then the offspring is a hybrid of human alien form.
And do you believe those hybrids are then walking among us on Earth? Are they taken back to some other planet, some other place?
Which is interesting, because one of Dr. Jacobs' books that came out just a few years ago is, you know, Walking Among Us, which talks about how the aliens are actually now integrated into our society and the process that that happens and how that all occurs. Do I believe it? You know, I have an open mind. I wrote two books about a related phenomena, so I have to have an open mind. I would say it's entirely possible.
Wow. You give lectures about these topics and your books all around the country. What's different about the way you approach this from other folks?
Well, I'm happily retired, so I don't have to this money-making venture. And if you ask the lady who does my taxes every year, I'm not making any money. I mean, it's a full-time effort when you're doing research. But the fact is, I don't have to enhance the work that I find. There's a lot of folks out there who make this a paying business, and that's their livelihood. And I don't really have to do that because I have a good government retirement based on 40 years. So I think I can maybe be a little bit more subjective and, you know, almost be blasé about it and, you know, not have to stand at the pulpit and beat it to death. I just try to tell the facts as I think I know them and let people make up their own minds without trying to force them into, you know, a certain belief, because that belief is going to make me financially better.
Do you think it's important, and do you do this work in part because it is important that people learn the truth?
Well, I did this work because I'm trying to find my own truth here, and I'm only trying to, you know, run to bedrock all of the rumors that I heard through the years working at Wright-Patterson. So I'm trying to just convince only myself that this is a real phenomena and there's some meat on the bone here. And if other people, it changes their ideas about it and it makes them more interested and they read about it more, then more power to them. I just think it's an interesting story, it's educational, and it's my story, so I just thought other people might want to hear about it.
And the 50 Shades of Greys is planned to be a trilogy. There are two books out now. What's the third one going to be about, and when will it be out?
Well, I'm not exactly sure, but what I'd really like to do is I'd like to take my metal detector and go to one of these sites like Roswell or the Plains of San Agustin and find an interesting piece of metal, and then have that metal tested by some experts and have them come back and go, you know what, this was not made on planet Earth. I mean, that would be a book unto itself. And it might be a small book, but I'd really love to do something like that. So I kind of want to get back to more of the trace cases where there's radioactive, you know, traces that are detectable by Geiger counters, or, you know, maybe finding an interesting meteorite that somebody goes, hey, you know, we've never found one of these before. I think I'd like to put that kind of book out there and maybe follow up on some other unfinished business. Like, there's a lot of stuff from Victoria's Secret Truth I just didn't put in the first book, and I think it merits mention. So, you know, maybe I'd finish up with another chapter about that.
I saw a documentary recently, and sadly, I don't remember the name of it, but it was about a doctor who was removing what were thought to be alien implants from folks, and they followed one gentleman who had something in his leg. Are you familiar with that particular story or any of these implant stories?
Oh, yeah. I'm very familiar with it. His name was Dr. Roger Lear.
Right.
And the documentary was probably called Alien Scalpel, after his famous book.
That may be so, yeah.
And Dr. Lear had upwards of about 20 patients, and they actually had the videotapes. And when they took out these implants, some of them displayed very unusual properties. In one case, they claimed that one of the objects, and it was a small, like, you know, the size of a pencil head, was actually transmitting on a very high frequency, putting out an unusual signal there. And it's, you know, it's not connected to a battery or anything, and yet this thing is transmitting a radio signal.
So,
Dr. Lear, unfortunately, he's passed on, but
yeah,
he was a pioneer in the field of removing these implants and having them tested. And in some cases, when they did the elemental analysis or the isotopic analysis, they discovered that this was metal not made on this planet.
So clearly, when you're on a show like this one, you're going to be able to get a fair hearing and have a good, open, and honest conversation. How does the mainstream or general media accept these discussions from you, or from anybody for that matter?
I've been on a Fox Morning Show. I've been on an NBC Morning Show. These people were fascinated to hear the story. You know, in all the interviews I've done, my first book came out in 2016. There's only one person that I wouldn't go back on their show because halfway through, they started to pontificate about how this is BS, and I was BS, and it was the planet Venus, and it was reflective ice crystals. And, of course, I let them, you know, babble on. But for the most part, you know, I've been welcomed with open arms, and people just want to know, you know, what I found out. Public television, film, you know, one of my presentations, you know, a 90-minute presentation, and it's out there on some, you know, PBR station. I had Fox News come out and record a whole 90-minute presentation. So I'm not really getting any blowback in all of this, and I wouldn't expect any, actually.
That's good to hear, because we often feel like these topics are maybe not quite ridiculed, but certainly looked at with a raised eyebrow from mainstream media. And we think it's important that these things be discussed. And whether you believe or not, or you agree or not, just the fact that we can have an open, honest discussion about it, I think, is a major step forward.
Now, even the Dayton Daily News, that, you know, anytime they get a chance to debunk a UFO sighting, especially if it's over Wright Pat, they do it in a heartbeat. And they printed a pretty positive article when I was doing a local presentation. That's probably, you know, a year or two ago. So, you know, they didn't give me a hard time. I thought the guy, his name was Barry Barber, very civil during the interview. I just, you know, expected worse, but it was very professional.
All right, so we're almost out of time here, Ray. Again, once more, give folks an idea where they can pick up the books and follow more of your work. And I know that you do lectures and speaking, and any place that you might be showing up that people could come see you talk.
Yeah, I'm going to be doing a lot of talks in the Dayton area this summer because I live there. I'd like to do the libraries because it's easy to book. It's free for me to do that. I know they pay me a little honorarium. So I'm going to be, they can check the Beaver Creek Library. I'll be there this year. The Troy Library, Fairborn Library, Bellbrook. I'm going to be doing a talk in Livonia, Michigan in July. I'll be up at the Headlands International Dark Sky Park in July to give a talk. So I usually post it on my website a couple weeks in advance.
That's terrific. Once again, your books are on Amazon.
Books are on Amazon. They can look me up under Raymond Szymanski on Facebook. It's pretty easy. I said I put the schedule on my website. I don't. I put the schedule on Facebook because I'm usually there more often. So if they want to check Facebook, they'll get to see some of my appearances, my upcoming appearances.
Perfect. Ray, thank you so much for spending the time with us and sharing your story. We hope to have you back on the program again when you get the third book.
Well, great. And tell Jason to show up this time because I got a question for him.
I will for sure. I will for sure. Once again, thanks for being here and have a great night. Again, Ray Szymanski, check him out on the web, and his books are on Amazon as well. And we have links to those books on Beyond Reality Radio social media as well. All right, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we'll wrap things up. It is Beyond Reality Radio. Please support the program. Go to patreon.com/Johaw. That's J-O-H-A-W. All right, so one of the great things about doing this show is that we've got a terrific audience, and we had a caller remind us that we had Gordon Lohr on the program not too long ago, and Gordon also an alien abductee and an experiencer and had an implant, an alien implant. I don't remember the details of that conversation because it's been a little bit of a time ago, but I do remember having it, and thank you for the reminder. Tomorrow night, we've got a couple of guests for you. We're going to split the show in two. Dylan Avery will be in the first part of the program to talk about his documentaries about 9/11, about police brutality, and the new documentary called Magic Molecule about CBD. And then Lee Austin will return to talk a little bit about Flat Earth Theory. He's got some new ideas there he wanted to present. So a lot of great stuff coming up on the program. As I said before, John Hogue, the Nostradamus scholar and expert, will be with us next Tuesday night, so a week from tonight. I'm anxious to have that discussion about Nostradamus. We've got a lot of people that are interested in it, so it should be a good one. And in addition to that, please stop by all our social media sites at Beyond Reality Radio and mine as well. YouTube, JV Johnson, Facebook, JV Johnson, or on Facebook, you can also find it by searching JVJ Paranormal. So that's going to about do it for tonight. I, again, appreciate you all being here. Appreciate Ray Szymanski being a great guest. We're going to have him back when his third book in the trilogy comes out. In the meantime, you can find 50 Shades of Grey's and its follow-up on Amazon, or you can click on the links that are right in our descriptions of our social media and our other posts. And then the final thing, I want you to go to scaricon.com. Check out what's going to be happening in Framingham, Massachusetts, June 7th through the 9th. It is going to be a fantastic event with a couple thousand people who all love the same things you do. Scaricon.com. Join us for that great weekend. That's going to do it for tonight. We'll see you tomorrow night. I'm JV Johnson. Thanks for being here.
Beyond Reality Paranormal is hosted by JV Johnson and produced by Orion Palmer and Slick Eddie Edwards. Like us on Facebook and subscribe to our YouTube channel. Please consider supporting the program either through your podcast platform, click on the link in the description, or on Patreon at Johaw Productions. If you'd like to be a guest on Beyond Reality Paranormal, or you have a recommendation for a guest, contact our producer, Slick Eddie Edwards. Eddie is spelled with a Y at slickeddieedwards@gmail.com.